underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Sebastian Barry is one of the most prominent Irish writers of his generation. In his latest novel, Days Without End, we discover America through the eyes of a young Irish immigrant fighting in the great wars of the mid-19th century. It is a vigorously researched historical novel about war, immigration, and the violent making of America, but it's also a moving love story between two gay men. Sebastian Barry's novels include A Long, Long Way and The Secret Scripture. He is a two-time winner of the Costa Book of the Year Award, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Sebastian Barry to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. A delight to have you back on the program.
It's lovely to talk to you again.
Thank you very much. We should note that as we record this, last night, you won your second Costa Book of the Year Award. So congratulations.
Thank you. My good grandfather, who was a great betting man, I don't know what odds he would have given against that, but they would have been very long indeed. It was an amazing night, actually.
Well, congratulations. And I would think, and we'll talk about this through the course of the interview, but I would think that given the personal nature of this novel, that perhaps could be even more rewarding than the first time around.
Yes, and one of the pleasures of last night, in the great din of the place where the award is given, I had my son Toby, to whom the book is dedicated, I think on a very complicated thing called Skype. And we couldn't hear each other, but I could see his happy, beaming 19-year-old face looking back at me from Ireland. And that was a double award then when I saw that. He was so happy about it.
So give us an idea of what brought you to Days Without End. And you have talked about how this book is inspired and dedicated to your son, who came out as gay recently. And you looked at that as an opportunity.
Well, it turned out to be an enormous privilege, an enormous resource of insight that I just couldn't have had otherwise. When he was 16... Toby, who is a wonderful boy, a wonderful musical boy, been composing since he was six, got very sad and I didn't know what was wrong with him. And, you know, myself and my wife, Ali, were terribly worried. And I'm sure all parents listening to this will understand why, because when a young man gets sad, you've really got to pay attention and try and find out why, even though probably at 16 you can't ask him directly because he wouldn't have words to tell you. Anyway, this went on for a while, and I was trying to move heaven and earth to see what it might be, just to help him and, you know, maybe ourselves to get some sleep and the worry to stop and all the rest of it. And then one day, on the advice of his older sister, you know, the philosopher in the house, he came into the bedroom and he said, listen, Dad, the thing is, I'm gay. It took me completely by surprise because I simply had no idea, because it was the solution to this dark time he'd been through and we'd been through worrying about him. I just felt an absolute, like being bathed in joy and freedom, because I thought, well, here can begin the healing and we're on better ground now. And as it happened, I was just reading for the book at the time. I was reading all the much history as I could and first-hand accounts. So it's that thing when you're in your workroom, you're doing your work, but also you're living your life. And that gets in on the book. The book draws all that into it. And it did in this case, because Toby spent the next couple of years instructing me on the ins and outs and the delicacies and the rarities of being gay. And we sat through our 20 hours of RuPaul's Drag Race, which I highly recommend to everybody. I mean, if you wanted a reality TV star to be president, I would have chosen RuPaul myself. And we just kind of learned from him. He taught me. He was my teacher and eventually my muse for the book, because the quality of his relationship with his boyfriend, I could see, was, you know, infinitely caring, infinitely delicate. And then I was thinking, well, this isn't something to be tolerated. This is something to almost envy. This is something to be emulated, celebrated. This is part of being a human person. And it's a beautiful instance of humanity. So all that got drawn slowly into the book. and changed probably the whole nature of the book if I had tried to write it 20 years ago. I mean, not only would I probably not have been able to get at the history and not been able to face up to the history I was reading, which obviously is quite terrifying in its some of its aspects, but it probably wouldn't have had this quality either. But I mean, that's the thing I relish most about writing, is that it takes me by surprise.
So you were already on your way of writing an historical novel set in America, as then you started to work through this with your son, and that is what drew you in and started to develop these characters.
Yeah, because my first sense of emergency actually probably dates back 50 years. It was when I was only 8 years old, and I'm sharing a room with my wonderful grandfather, who was an amazing storyteller, who'd been all over the world, had wreaked havoc, I'm afraid, on his own family while he was a drinking man, but had stopped drinking, and by then was just this fantastic rescuer of my childhood and my friend. And he'd bring me across the country in the old Cortina, Ford Cortina, to see the relatives, which I loved. In fact, he gave me what I write about. And one evening, one probably dark, rainy evening in County Dublin, in Monkstown, an old mansion by the sea, the two of us in the bed, him telling me stories, he just mentioned in passing that a great uncle of his had been at the Indian Wars. And actually, he didn't tell a story about him. That's all he knew about him. That's all that survived. And I was incredibly intrigued because, as you can imagine, as a young boy in that era in the 60s, our mythology was not Cuchulainn and the Fianna and the Irish mythologies, but the cowboy films. That's what we understood as mythology. And the Marx Brothers, and the Marx Brothers Go West. I mean, even they did a cowboy film. They were so wise. And so I thought I knew what that meant. But, you know, it took me 50 years really to truly understand what that means for a young Irish person who maybe lost his family in the famine to go to America with nothing, absolutely destitute, and try and make a go of it then in the army and the Indian Wars and in the War of Independence and just survive. You know, it is really a story of survival. And one of the things that he helps him survive best is the love he has for this other destitute boy that he meets under a hedge in Missouri called John Cole.
And John Cole is based on your son's boyfriend.
Well, let me say, it's really kind of, you know, if the research you do, the sort of hyper-interested fatherly research you do, and just and observing the people around you, and just observing how Toby and his boyfriend, who is in fact called Jack, interact with each other and care for each other and try and inhabit each other's brains in a way that, you know, is deeply empathetic. I mean, I was hugely impressed by this, and actually made me more hopeful for the human race. And it was a great solace to me as a human being to see this. And so that's the quality that I tried, or rather the book sort of drew into itself, that these two men are so wedded to each other. I mean, so devoted to each other. I mean, Thomas doesn't say too much about it. I don't think he feels he needs to. It's not really what he's most primarily interested in talking about, but it is the thing that is, you know, precious to him. It's the center of his being. And in fact, it's the very guarantee of his survival as a person in America.
It certainly comes through in the novel that you want to portray that joy much more than what we often read about, which is the shame and persecution.
You see, this enormous irony, which you know, you will appreciate yourself, with Irish roots, is that, just loosely speaking, as an Aboriginal people, like the Irish in Ireland, and although, you know, it's a complicated story and we were complicit and we were not complicit, etc., with colonialism, nevertheless, you know, somebody like Cromwell came into Ireland and wanted to basically, I mean, by his judgment, just exterminate the people that he found there so that he could put nice English people in and create a paradise. So, you know, this was something that actually the O'Haras, who are the real family behind the McNulty's, did experience one way or another. So you'd think you'd have a huge understanding of the ill-advised nature and the murderous nature of a dispossession of a native people. But no, you know, he goes to America, he joins the army, and he's engaged in the movement against Native American peoples. So it's not really a question of guilt for him. This is a man who has seen his family die on the stone floor of their house back in Sligo. And he's gone out as a little boy, basically, on his own and fled to America on the famine ships and come through the fever sheds and come through God knows what else and has drifted down into America. And, you know, this isn't an America with social services. This is an America with supermarkets or malls. This is an America where if you didn't work for your dollar, you died, basically. You know, there was absolutely no safety net. So he is actually a good soldier, ironically, but he is engaged in this terrible dispossession of, you know, a most splendid and extraordinarily magisterial people who, you know, if they weren't in America before Europeans for 14,000 years, well, they were there for 40,000 years. So we may imagine, we may assume that they knew how to live in their America. But by the time he gets to them, of course, they, you know, the turmoil and the job of extermination, removal and diminishment has been underway for a couple of hundred years.
Sebastian Barry is our guest. The name of the new novel, Days Without End. It is published by Viking. So let us talk about what led you to a historical novel set in America. What was that like for you to take on and the challenge that it gave you?
I loved history at school, but I wasn't very good at dates. And actually, I don't think I was very good at the idea of the past. Uh-huh. I thought maybe if you could inhabit imaginatively a space in some year, call something maybe that seems far away, that you could actually make it present again. So, I mean, the ironical job of the historical novelist is to make it as if it were the present. That's to say, as if the future doesn't exist. You have to go back and not anticipate anything that's going to happen, because obviously your characters don't know what's going to happen, either on the smaller level in their own lives or on the bigger level in the decades ahead. It's really a way of writing about the present without all the mess and chaos of the present and the distraction. But in order to do it, I mean, in order to do it at least convincingly to yourself as the writer, you know, you have to read for it. I had to read for a year. I mean, there was no way I could make up these things in their entirety. I was terribly interested in the Irish involvement, say, in the Civil War as well, because I was reading things that really surprised me. I won't even say shocked me, but do you know when young fellows of military age got off the boats in the 1860s during the Civil War from Ireland, you know, and between 1847, which is Black 47, the famine years, and the 1860s, another 2 million people had left Ireland. So when they got off the boats, you know, they were put straight into the Union Army if they arrived in those districts, or the Confederate Army, far fewer, but if they arrived in the South. And they were put into uniform, and they said, you're going to be in uniform now because you have to earn your citizenship. This was something I simply didn't know. And it gave rise to the idea of, you know, thousands upon thousands of young Irish people whose whole future had been erased behind them, the family that they loved, all the things they were going to do in their lives, all the people who would love them had been erased. And the first thing they do when they arrive in this completely unknown country, and you have to think of it as, you know, not a landscape stretching ahead of them or anything they knew about, just completely blank thing in their imaginations and straight into an army. You know, and how angry they must have been at some level. And in a way also, I thought about how dangerous young Irish people must have been and how violent they must have been. And all those things, for a human person, you might say, are quite affrighting. You know, you could be fearful of it. But for a writer, it's in a sense slightly wicked, because it's a huge opportunity. You want to grasp it. You want to enter into it. You want to be excited about it. And this is probably, I would safely say, in 39 years of writing, you know, the most exciting or the most thrilling book for me, that in the writing of it, because I was literally hearing and seeing Thomas showing me this world after my year of reading, my 9 months of trying to wait for the book to start. And once it got going, it was as if it was never the past. You know, it hopefully maybe even a bit of the future. If we could have a future as it seems, if gay people could live in that time, in this turmoil, like unmolested and without prejudice, as I think they could, you could just for a few short years in that nascent America full of possibility, then if that could be in the future, then my son never has to worry about being singled out or humiliated in his own, you know, what I hope will be a glorious future.
And yet there must be a sobering side to that as well, as you read headlines where it's still a fight.
It's a huge fight, and it depends what you're talking about. You know, Uganda, it's a death penalty. Russia's not much better. You know, I've tried to inform myself about LGBTI issues because Toby is my beloved son and I want to know as much as I can. And you're absolutely right. And it's a fight where you wouldn't expect it to be. I mean,
Well, even in the United States.
Well, you know, it grieves me to hear that because, yes, I know. I mean, we've all been through this trauma of recent weeks. But, you know, the core value of America, the values to which one hopes every president or every politician or every citizen tends are so important to Americans. It's the reason that causes that strange love of America in people who even have never been there, who dream of it as a country far away. And yes, of course, it is also the site of the most ferocious racism, of the most ferocious phobia against people, against immigrants. But if that tendency towards good is there, then, you know, you could say that the very heart of America is intact. So I'm grieving to hear you say that, but obviously it's true as well. I mean, even in a rural train in Ireland, when Toby was on the train recently, after the marriage referendum, after we won that referendum, he was on a train with his boyfriend, kissed his boyfriend goodbye. And when his boyfriend got off the train, some of the people in the carriage thought that licensed them to come over and sit beside him and menace him and upset him and humiliate him. I mean, isn't that the most, in its own level, the most disgusting thing you can think of? I mean, it's an absolutely horrendous thing because this boy is just the most wonderful young man. And, you know, how bloody dare they do it? And the reason they dare do it is because they think they're licensed to, and that's prejudice.
I do want to mention the fact that you've brought this up a few times of the reading, the intense reading that you did for this novel in preparation in the writing. A lot of this had to do with primary sources from the 19th century, including diaries of soldiers and really these firsthand accounts of life on the frontier and captivity.
All firsthand accounts. I mean, because I'm also after the language. I mean, I had a certain dispensation, you might say, from the fact that Thomas is Irish. So There was a certain license there. But nevertheless, he is tending towards an American. Some of the things that were fascinating to me, just trying to get at the lingo or the language or English as it existed in America then, which probably you can't hear any instance of now, is that, you know, in the old accounts of being taken by Native American peoples, Europeans were held captive. Often after, you know, in their account, their whole family was killed. But at the end of the day, they wanted to remain with the tribe to which they were then affiliated because they loved the life. All those surprising things, you know, you read in American history. And of course, sometimes very hating accounts of the same events, you know, at different times. But also the simple things like a man called William Otter, he wrote his autobiography. No one ever published it. I think a university press did much, much later, maybe in the 1910s. And he was just a plasterer. Now, I must say, in my view, as a person who rebuilt his house over 2 years, a plasterer is a god. But anyway, a good plasterer is a double god. But anyway, he's a plasterer in this book, and he's just talking about his life. And you hit on that very interesting thing, you know, not being guilty about things. With totally without guilt, he describes him and his friends getting their weapons together, their clubs and whatever, and going down into the Irish districts of wherever he is, Philadelphia, and having these terrible melees and bloody fights with them as a sort of sport. And you can see, therefore, you know, that sort of violence is a kind of pastime. It's a recreation. I mean, extraordinary accounts. And the next minute he's telling you about this man's house where he finished off 7 rooms for him and he paid him X amount of dollars. Do you know? It's moving from incredible levels of violence to very, very intimate, expert, domestic settings. And quite extraordinary. And those books were valuable to me. I mean, a book for sheer vision, showing you, was Francis Parkman's Oregon Trail. I'm sure if you're familiar with that. Mm-hmm. Francis Parkman gloried in the title of the first great American historian, but tragically, I probably picked the wrong subject for his great opus. But one of his smaller books was this book he wrote about going west when he was 19 after Harvard, and he went up to find Native American peoples that hadn't been touched by Europeans. That was his intent. And he wrote this amazing book. And oddly enough, the book is based on his diaries of the time. He wrote the book 20 years after he'd been. The diaries are quite xenophobic. They're quite unpleasant. They're very highfalutin, kind of upper class, nose lifted up against the other people on the Missouri boats and all the rest of it. But that's not in this book. It's funny, he must have edited it out of his heart over the 20 years and wrote this incredible book. And in that, you get a buffalo hunt. You get these, just these moments of sheer detail and expertise that you cannot get, you know, from a history book per se. You're just getting an eyewitness account, and, you know, how privileged we are, you know, as readers to have these at our disposal.
We talk about the connection this novel has to your son, but this is something that you have done throughout your work in connecting characters to your family and also characters in your novels being connected with other characters in other novels.
Yes, and I think my best experiences as a writer have been those people who only do have half a sentence remaining of their entire existence on this earth. You know, the sort of the great uncle who went to the First World War, you know, in a British uniform to fight for, you know, the freedom of Catholic Belgium or whatever he wanted to do. But nothing was remembered of him, so that was all to make up. Roseanne McNulty in The Secret Scripture, I mean, I did have a great aunt who was sectioned, put into an asylum, as they said in those days, for some sort of accusation, I don't know, of being nymphomaniac or something. I think they put her in because she was beautiful. Mm. And again, nothing remembered of her. I think she was the piano player in my great uncle's band in Strandhill in Sligo, if any of your listeners ever danced there in their youth. But, you know, forgotten people about whom nothing is remembered are very much more delightful to me as their descendant DNA-wise than the ones I've known maybe too much about. People like my grandfather, who obviously I knew a lot about from my mother, who obsessively told me stories about that. And so it's an imaginary family, you know, that I've built around me. But I have to say, as a father of three kids and, you know, married to Ali for 30 years, this imaginary family has stood me well, maybe just as well as a real family, as a basis for just trying to enter onto that crazy art of being a parent and you know, experience my own days without end, which in my phrase means those great days in your life when you're not thinking much about being young, you're not thinking much about ending, you're just deep in the great fever of life. You know, that's partly I call these ghosts to my back for protection in that journey.
But to me, there is a beauty and a joy that you appreciate that and know it, which of course I think also comes with age, but also you have there's a compassion that you must have to want to hear those stories and to hear those voices and to know what they're saying is important.
You know, and the birdsong of any man or woman who has lived a life on this earth is to be honored even for that, just for that. To live a life on this earth is deserving, in my mind, of a kind of medal of valor. You know, it's not an easy task. In this book, there's a man called Starling Carlton who, you know, his reputation before he's joined the army is that he's been a stealer of Native American children to sell them in San Francisco as servants or worse. You know, that is a terrible reputation to have as a human being. But he's come into the army and he's a big, rough man and he's, you know, fairly dreadful. And he does meet a terrible fate towards the end of the book. But at the same time, Thomas relishes him. He loves him in some way, because I think Thomas, you know, is the writer of this book in the sense that he tells the story. And just as you're saying, his empathy is wide. His empathy is deep. He loves human creatures and he is sometimes perplexed by the world and he realizes that it is, you know, a violent and unfair world. But the people whom he's happened to travel the road with, you know, he has the deepest respect and empathy for. And I value that in him. And I just felt actually rather solaced by him and inspired by him in so much as you can be, you know, sitting in a little workroom in the Wicklow Mountains, trying to see and hear the whisper of this long vanished man.
Do you think that comes from the DNA of being a writer or your upbringing or your genetics as an Irishman?
I mean, I think it's all those things, but genetics as an Irishman, I'd have to put a question mark over. Like all peoples, I mean, if we are a people, we are capable of extraordinary, redeeming generosity and flashes of greatness and all the rest of it. But still, you can make an argument. I had to conclude after reading for a year, you could make an argument that our contribution to American history had also been oftentimes very violent, very questionable, and that our capacity, for instance, if I may say, for racism in America towards black people is a shameful, if you wish to talk about shame, part of our history. I mean, Thomas observes, for instance, the fact that, and this isn't anything to do with being Irish, but he observes when he's in the Union Army, as soon as they're captured and they're going to be put in the dreaded Andersonville prison, the black troops, the guys who've joined up to fight in the Union Army, are instantly and summarily and without trial executed by the Southern troops. And Thomas and John observed this as prisoners themselves, but, you know, they obviously deeply shocked by it. And that there's these parts of the history that as a person, as I say, might affright you, but as a novelist are incredibly interesting, because I think it's from the admission of our richness, our ambiguity of our evil and our good, that you begin to get a proper history of that world. You know, it's predicated upon terrible things and yet led oftentimes to a condition that so often you can speak about the glories of America.
Sebastian Barry's new novel is Days Without End. It is published by Viking. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.